I started reading the John Steinbeck journal for East of Eden, and I'm not fully done. I'm like halfway done with it. It's an easy read. It's just basically like his journal to his, well, he basically wrote it as letters to his publisher, who he's like friends with, like personal friends with. Obviously, he's written at this point like Mice and Men and Grapes of Wrath and obviously a bunch of other stuff. So he's like personal friends with his publisher. And this journal is like his warm-up writing before he starts writing East of Eden. It's like his way of like getting in the mood. And he doesn't actually mail these letters to his publisher. He's going to give him, basically he's writing his book by hand. I never realized that. He wrote East of Eden by hand. So one side of the page is East of Eden and the other side of the page is like, he only writes on, I think on the right side of the page for East of Eden, and then the left side is his notes if it's not the letter to the publisher, but he also has notes about the book to himself, basically to remind himself of like the plot and like where things are going. But it reminded me of Prolific, because Prolific, for people that don't know, it's the writing app that Nat and the Deal are working on. He's basically like talking about word count, like how he felt when he was writing it, like as part of his warm-up, he's like, I hope to get this many words done, or at this pace, I'll be done with the first draft by this time. And like, he also tries not to write too much because he wants to leave like a little bit on the table for the next day. And like all these different tactics that I've heard you guys talk about.
That's too funny.
It's just awesome.
We got to add Penguin to Prolific so they can keep tabs on that.
I love it.
Dude, also the journal has so many interesting tidbits, like the title was supposed to be the Salinas Valley for a while, which is a way more boring title and like definitely doesn't grip you at all. Then he had, I forget what, there was like a middle working title that he had. And then East of Eden, he actually stumbled upon as he was writing the book. There's like a Bible passage that he's like working on. And he's like, hear me out, East of Eden, to like his publisher in the thing. And then he just started testing it out, like with his wife and with like other people. There was like one like random oil guy he met at like some party, and he's like, this is a good representation of like the average American and like somebody who reads novels but not like, you know, a scholar or something, right? And like, he's like, I tested the title on him and he really seemed to like it and was curious to learn more about the book.
It is a beautiful title. So these are all in the notes.
Yeah, it's all in the journal. Yeah.
I would love to get a copy of East of Eden that's printed with the notes on the corresponding page.
That would have been so cool. That would have been so cool. It's also, apparently he had horrible handwriting. So one of the other issues he had with this draft. So basically at the end of the week, his assistant would like type up what he had handwritten, and then they would airmail it to the publisher to like review, the editor and the publisher to review. And apparently there were typos and all sorts of stuff going wrong because his handwriting's really ugly, like really messy. So then the publisher would be like, that was something that didn't make sense. And then he'd be writing it in this letter and be like, yeah, I need to really get my handwriting better, but my pencils aren't good enough. And like, come on. And the funny thing is,
wait, was he mailing in pages for the first draft?
Yes.
Or was this like a later
draft? First draft. First draft, yeah. I think he was like personal friends with, like, he, it seemed like this publisher that he worked with was somebody he like almost collaborated with, because in these notes he's even talking about like, you know, you came over to my house today. Like, basically the publisher got all these letters after the book was done. It was like his gift to his publisher. So he's like commenting.
They're probably as like an editor as much.
Exactly. Yeah, and it almost sounded like he was like almost a collaborator even for the plot, like things that didn't make sense, things that did make sense. Like they debated for a long time, because like Steinbeck is actually, not to get into East of Eden too much, but Steinbeck is a Hamilton, like in real life. Like he is the son of Olive, I think, was his mom.
Yeah, that was mentioned in the book. I thought that was fictional.
No,
so he says in the journal, every single Hamilton story is true. The Trask ones are the ones where he took a lot of creative liberty. But every single Hamilton story is true, which is interesting.
Wow, that hits different.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is interesting.
This is why the journal is so, it made reading the book this time, this is only my second time reading it, just like, I read the book and then I read the journal, but everything was so fresh because I literally just finished the book. And I was like, whoa, this is wild.
All right, gotta pick up the journal.
Yeah, that's happening.
Yeah, anyway, I've so many things highlighted.
I'm so excited.
It is also like, and sometimes the journal is boring, I will say, because it's literally just his like notes as he's writing. Like sometimes it's literally just like, I don't feel like writing today. And then he'll like ramble for like a page. And then he's like, okay, I think I'm warmed up. Talk to you later.
He's just like us.
Yeah.
One of us.
But we are not talking about East of Eden in this episode. That is next time.
Nope.
We are talking today about Logic Comics.
Logic Comics. I suggested this one. A friend at work said it was one of his favorite books. And he was a very interesting person. So I figured any book that must rank highly for him must be good. And I think it delivered.
Yeah, it was also just fun reading like a graphic novel. I don't think I'd read a graphic novel in since I was like a child. Not a child, but maybe like a teenager. Great choice. I feel like we should do more graphic novels, not just because they're quicker to read and get through.
But also because they're quicker to read.
Yeah.
I mean, I have Watchmen and V for Vendetta on my shelf. I haven't read Watchmen in probably 10 years and never read V for Vendetta. And they're both considered to be two of the greats, I believe.
I have not read either. What is Logic Comics about? Like, I was trying to describe it to somebody and I was like, is it about Bertrand Russell's life? Kind of like, obviously about, well, his central, like the stuff that he worked on in his life for sure. But it's, I don't know. It's also just like a story too at the same time. Like a,
I think it's chase for the discovering the foundations of mathematics. It's like that filter on Bertrand Russell's life. Would you even classify him as a main character in that, or is he the most interesting character? So they chose him for the story.
That is a good question. You know what's interesting is I actually didn't even know he had. I mean, we've done a Bertrand Russell episode before with In Praise of Idleness. I didn't even know he worked on this.
Well, he had essentially stepped back from math and logic by the time he was 40.
Right.
And then I think he lived to be 98. So he had many, many prolific years afterwards for philosophy. And he was a huge pacifist, and all of his war engagements were afterwards as well, I believe.
Yeah, it's interesting. He almost like, I don't know, this was like his early, like this was actually the early part of his career. And then he gave up, not gave up, but like.
Yeah, set it aside.
And then started praising idleness.
It's easy to praise idleness when you're born into a wealthy family and just think about logic all
day.
That
is true.
You know? It's like, Bertrand, you wrote a book called The Conquest of Happiness. Tell us how you conquested happiness from your small castle.
Yeah. Step one. Be born rich.
Thanks, Bertie.
Well, we can get into the discussion topics, but just like before we move into any of the topics, his life also just like sounds like his parents were in like a throuple, which was very, I don't know if that, okay. So I will say this before I start like saying things that may or may not be true. One of the criticisms of this book when I was doing research was that they took a lot of liberties with like the actual like facts, like. And I don't think they were like criticized too heavily for it because it is a graphic novel. It's not a biography of Bertrand Russell. But like that is one of the facts. I don't know if that was true or not, because there's like some things like when I was reading about the reception to the book and what happened after it came out, that was one of the things I got criticized for, that there's like some events presented as historical events that happened, like him meeting certain philosophers or other mathematicians, and they didn't actually happen.
I would love to hear if that one was made up, the throuple.
I'm gonna Google it.
Why they worked that one in. That'd be a surprising one.
Yeah, of all the things you
lob in
up,
there for no reason.
Yeah, why make up?
Yeah.
I bet that one's true. I saw some of those too, Neil, and like they drew him going to a couple of meetings he never could have gone to. There were some things like that it was like, okay. But
okay, this is true. This was true. The throuple is true. Yep. Interesting.
His parents were in a polycule.
Yeah. Progressive parents.
And it sounds like he also had, how would you say, would it run in the family? Because he had two children diagnosed with schizophrenia and I believe his brother and an uncle, if that's right.
Some crazy number.
They made that a pretty major focus of the book.
Yeah. Well, yeah, when we were talking about like what is the book about, it did feel like a big part or like the biggest theme of the book felt like it was about how the search for ultimate truth in the world will like drive you crazy. Right. Just because so many of these logicians go mad, and he kind of like seems a little shaky at times too.
I'm going to steal something from you, Nat, which you usually bring up in every episode, but I'm going to bring it up this time. It's almost like a little bit of a Zen type of thing where it's like they're looking for, or a Tao type of thing, right? They're like looking for like precision. And that's like, in some ways drives them mad because the world doesn't exactly work like that. They're looking for like formal rules that explain how the world works. And since it may or may not work that way, it seems like, you know, it's very hard to define a system, which we'll get into. That's like a lot of what the struggle was about. It might drive them crazy. Like they just crave this order that just doesn't exist in the world.
I was going to say, I think that's all, that's why they like structured the book the way they did to Neil, because I mean, and this is sort of like how the story gets, or the story in the real world happened too, but it's kind of like perfect that the book ends with Gödel's incompleteness theorem. Because it's like, that is sort of a meta commentary on Russell's life, right? It's like, he's trying to find the answers to all of these problems. And like, at the end of the day, you just like, can't do it from within the system. Right. And it's like tying it to the Zen or Tao analogy, right? It's like, yeah, you can't explain it from the inside. Go back and listen to the Gödel Escher Bach episode. The quick version of incompleteness theorem, as I understand it, is that no system can fully explain itself. You have to like step outside of it. So like Russell's attempt to prove mathematics within, or prove mathematics and logic within the existing confines of mathematics and logic, you would eventually have to like step above it to close the gaps. Or step outside of it to close the gaps.
Does GEB talk about Agrippa's trilemma with axiom, circular reasoning, and infinite regression?
It's been too long. I bet it's in there.
It's been a long time.
Pull it off the shelf.
They touch on that briefly here as well with like turtles all the way down and circular proofs. And then axioms are basically the escape hatch. You have to define an axiom to be able to try to explain anything from within a system.
No reference to Agrippa.
Check one other one, the Munchausen trilemma. In epistemology, the Munchausen trilemma is a thought experiment intended to demonstrate the theoretical impossibility of proving any truth. There are only three ways of completing a proof. The circular argument, in which the proof of some proposition presupposes the truth of that very proposition. The regressive argument, in which each proof requires further proof ad infinitum, and the dogmatic argument, or axioms, which rests on accepted precepts, which are merely asserted rather than defended.
No, I think under trilemma, and then you said Munchausen.
Interesting.
One thing that I was thinking about that kind of frames the whole topic a little bit, it's probably worth bringing up here, is like this idea of basically creating a formal system to describe the world, or to describe even like with formal mathematics, being able to describe the world. It's like almost trying to put if you think it goes back to that map terrain idea, right? It's like, they're basically trying to build like the perfect map.
Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting question because it's like, A, is it even possible? And I think that was almost like what drove them all these mathematicians a little bit crazy, is like realizing that maybe it's not quite possible to build the perfect math, in which case they're probably thinking like, then what's the whole point of this whole thing? And that they've spent years of their life, right? So it's like a lot of effort and time, and it was like kind of like the holy grail of mathematics. It seemed like the way they were describing it was almost like a race to see who could do it first. And actually they thought they did it, right? And then it was kind of disproven by Gödel, right?
I don't think they ever thought they did it, because I think they sort of like...
Oh, yeah. They didn't think they did it. It was just volume one of the thing.
Yeah, they just published it because they were like, yeah, maybe somebody will get something out of this. Like,
yeah.
But it's interesting. I was kind of proud of this. Like when you're reading it, Russell's paradox clearly sets up Gödel for the incompleteness theorem. Like you can really see the seeds in that. And so that part I thought was kind of interesting, where it's like, oh yeah, they tried to do this like 500, 600 page, whatever, treatise proof, but it was like this one sentence idea that ended up kind of helping provide the keystone for him.
Can you draw the line between those two?
Yeah, let's see. Russell's paradox was the barber, right?
Yeah, it was you can't have the set that contains everything because it would have to contain itself.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the core of the incompleteness theorem, is that it can't also contain an explanation of itself, right? Like it's something along those lines.
Yeah, there was, I mean, Adil, you have this in the notes too, like the set theory paradox. It says whether the set, this is what you're talking about, right? Whether the set of all sets that do not contain themselves as a member includes itself or not. If it does, it contradicts its definition. If it doesn't, it must include itself according to its definition. I think one of the examples they gave in the book too, right, was like the whole thing, like, I am telling a lie.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. Is that a true or false statement?
The barber example, if I recall, was, I think everyone has to get a haircut and they cannot cut their own hair.
Oh, yeah. That was a great one.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember how it ends, though. I don't.
It's also interesting that, Nat, while you're looking that up, it's also interesting that, like, in, seems like historically, logic, philosophy, and math were, like, very much the same, right? Or like within the same department.
Yeah.
And now like in modern education, you would consider like philosophy like a liberal art and math like a technical major. And they're I don't know how similar they are. I mean, Nat, did you do like formal logic as part of philosophy?
I took one class, yeah.
Okay. So it is still connected
though. Totally. Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if you do that in math too. Like if you're a math major, I wonder if you take a logic class.
Probably. I mean, geometry touches on it.
Yeah.
A decent amount. Like, I'm sure it's in there somewhere.
I'm trying to remember. There was a proofs class that I had to take. I'm not a math major, but what was it called? I think, but to answer your question, Neil, at least at CMU, I believe the answer to that was yes.
It would make sense, right? Because like reading this, you realize how close like all of these three things are.
Yeah. Like the landscape of mathematics is so much larger than just, you know, like the algebra, geometry, calculus that most people do.
Yeah, or what you would think of as math, like solving an equation or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Although that is also logic if you think about it.
Yeah. Like
solving an equation is logic in some ways. Mm-hmm. Well, not in some ways, it is.
It actually is, yeah.
It was called Concepts of Mathematics, main focus on presenting basic logic and the methods of mathematical proof.
Yeah,
that was a really hard class.
That's why Adil's not a math major.
That's why Adil's not a math major. Did it almost drive you crazy? Oh, man. Good times.
What major did you end up getting, Adil?
Oh, let's not talk about it while being recorded.
I actually don't know that either.
I switched like five times and then...
I know,
Do you remember that tool... Because after I like dropped out and dropped back in, I came back and I was going to be on loans my final year. And they had this tool, I forget what it was called, where you can plug in all the classes you've taken and it will tell you like how far along you are for like various degrees. Mm. And I was like furthest along for this degree I had never been in. Just by moving around, I like picked up all these various credits. So my in the end, my degree was decision science, which is essentially is like behavioral econ and stats. No. And psych. Yeah, it sounds like a much more BS thing than it really was. Like it was behavioral econ and stats, which is actually quite interesting. But I've been made fun of for 10 years, and whenever people need to make a decision, they're like, "Hey, heard you majored in decision science."
In the science of decisions.
Oh, I'm gonna pull that on you for sure.
That's why I've only made good decisions.
Exactly.
I have a major.
Exactly.
It's good that there were a lot of stats classes in that major, because all of the like softer side of it has just been like completely thrown out the last 10 years.
That's right. One of the upsides. The other upside might be that I just didn't do anything with the degree in the end.
What do you mean? You've been making perfect decisions for 10 years.
Yeah.
Thank you. It was interesting to see. So the of the main notable mathematicians in the book, how many of them were you guys familiar with before? Like you had Frege, Cantor, Hilbert, obviously Gödel we had talked about, and then Wittgenstein. I think I'm saying that correctly.
Yeah, I think I only knew Wittgenstein and Gödel.
Same.
Have you guys read any of Wittgenstein's work?
I tried to read Tractatus once. I had no idea what the fuck was going on.
Yeah, let me look at which one I tried to read. I also did not. Is that the one, Nat, that was just like literally just like each... Like it was just sentences. Like it was like one.
Yeah.
This.
It's like sentences and proofs. Like in his first, it makes no sense.
Is that from when he was?
I tried to read it too. Yeah, that's the one I tried to read as well. I think I own it, but I didn't get very far. Just gave up.
Is that the one from when he was young and he said he had solved all of philosophy, or is that one of his later?
I think that's the one. Yeah.
Okay.
It was written in 1921, and he was 32, I think. When he published that.
He just seems like such an interesting guy. So he fights in World War One or World War Two. But yeah, I think it was World
It would be
I think
World
one.
War
One.
One.
Yeah, World War One.
Yeah. One, yeah.
He gets imprisoned and he's in an Italian prison, I believe. And then he solves all of philosophy. And then he starts like gardening and
one does in prison.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as he says, he solves all of philosophy. And then he starts like gardening and like just doing odds and ends for like 20 years. Then he changes his mind, comes back, and he's like, sorry, this was a bit dogmatic. I shouldn't have said that. And starts writing all over again. Do you guys know what he did later in life? Are you guys familiar with any of that?
No.
I'm looking at his Wikipedia page right now. Wow, he also had a bunch of like suicides in his family.
Yeah, I think three of his siblings. Like. Yep, three of his siblings.
Jeez.
What kind of was it? We were talking about this some episode a while ago that there's some like research, or maybe it's just like observational, that the wiring for like high creativity seems very close to the wiring for like bipolar disorder and a lot of other mental health things like that. I don't remember where this was, but it was like a common theme like this that very creative people either themselves have significant mental health issues or they have a lot of family members who do. And it's like, sometimes you get the combination, you get a good version of the combination. It works out. And a lot of times you get the less good.
That intuitively checks out. I wonder if it is true.
Yeah. Or it could even just be like the way someone's life sort of goes, takes them in one direction or the other, but it's like the same wiring. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm looking up Wittgenstein right now.
Mm-hmm. So am I. One other interesting thing about Russell, while we look that up, he was very, very prominently calling for a new commission into he basically published a highly critical article about the Warren Commission and JFK's assassination and was like convinced that Oswald was innocent.
Really? Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah, and compared it to, there was something that happened in late 19th century France in which the state convicted an innocent man, was basically like a fall guy kind of thing in France. And he was basically saying this is the American equivalent. And he's also criticizing the American press for not like publicizing any voices critical of the official version of events. Huh. He also was involved in the Cuban Missile Crisis, apparently, where he was exchanging telegrams with Khrushchev, trying to get reassurance that the Soviets would not be reckless. Hmm. He was, I guess, very influential, obviously, if he's exchanging telegrams with the Soviet premier. Yeah.
What? There's something about that that just doesn't really check out. It's not like he had Twitter and he could just DM him or something. Like there's probably someone on Khrushchev's side who was like, yeah, we've received a message from Bertrand Russell.
Well, didn't he win a Nobel Prize? Like, yeah, he was definitely a celebrity.
I think he's pretty famous, right?
But still a West versus Soviets kind of a setup. Like, I wonder how they established their relationship.
Yeah. Well, it seems like he was somewhat friendly with them, because that was one of the criticisms that he was getting.
Oh, really?
That he was like a communist sympathizer, because he was a pacifist, remember? So he was like very anti-nuclear weapons. And he was also very critical of JFK during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He apparently sent JFK a message. He sent this they actually have the telegram he sent to Kennedy. Your action desperate, threat to human survival, no conceivable justification. Civilized man condemns it. We will not have mass murder. Ultimatum means war and end this madness. I think he sent something very similar to Khrushchev. Wow. We just don't have the actual telegram from that one. So that means he's also communicating with Kennedy. So, wow.
Do we have people like that today? Like just pure thinkers of that kind of sway?
Yeah, that's interesting.
So like, you know, technologists certainly do, right? Like, I get the sense that Musk and Zuckerberg and the, you know, Bezos can, I guess maybe not as much Bezos because the international, but like they can probably have that kind of outreach. But like, do you have any think boys who are sending letters to political leaders?
Yeah, it's almost on the merit of your thoughts rather than the size of your business.
You've all know a Harari, maybe.
Probably.
Potentially. Yeah. I mean, he's at, yeah.
Controversial, yeah. But.
Not Taleb.
Well, Russell was also controversial, so actually fits the archetype, right? You probably could even say, to some degree, you could probably say something about like Jordan Peterson as well.
Yeah. I guess Russell.
Yeah, like professor kind of thing. Like, yeah.
How popular was Russell among, you know, the general public?
Well, so here's one thing I think we're not considering with Russell. Mm-hmm. Russell was a part of like the British royalty, right? Like not royalty, but like aristocracy.
Yeah. His father was like Lord some.
Yeah. That's kind of.
Yeah.
Help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was at a time when Britain, I think like we also discount today what Britain was at that time. It's like Britain was not like a junior partner to the US at that time. I think they were, I mean, when was he born? Like if he lived that long, like he was born in 1872. Yep. Yeah. 1872. I mean, that was like, I don't know if that was peak British Empire, but it was very strong period of the British Empire history. So I would imagine that's like probably being like on par, not with maybe being like a Kennedy, but being like, I don't know, being like a very, like you're from like a powerful family.
Yeah.
Clinton. Yeah. We might not even have an equivalent in America. We might not even have the equivalent of this.
It's hard to know what it was. I don't think I have a clear enough conception of what it was to draw a comparison.
Kardashian.
Well, was the House of Lord, like the Lord thing, like, was that a hereditary thing or no? Was that like based on an elected position? I just don't know enough about how the British system worked.
Should we detour to Kate Middleton conspiracies?
Adil, is this where your heart starts pounding?
Can you guys hear it?
His mic is on his chest, and Nat, before you joined, he was like, this is where like you guys are going to hear my heartbeat if Nat makes an off-color joke.
Oh, I didn't even hear.
Have you guys not been following this? There's nothing off-color about
Wait, what was the joke?
I actually want to dive into it because I don't know enough about it. I just know it like, I was thinking it's something that's just going to blow over in a day, and I was like, I don't care about these people.
It didn't click on anything. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. Oh my God.
Go ahead and answer the question.
Then. This is the wildest, most abrupt tangent. I just realized what you guys are talking about the Photoshop thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can't even figure out what it's about.
It's not a tangent. We're talking about the British royalty. Like it's not a tangent. This is on topic.
Cosette and I watched like 20 minutes of highly authoritative investigative journalism on the topic last night.
Why is the controversy? what's the implication of like the worst possible thing that could be?
What's the implication of the worst possible thing could be? I guess the implication of the worst possible thing could be that the royal family's trying to get rid of her or something. I don't really know what the accusation would be. It's more just pointing out that it's weird that like that she went in for a like routine scheduled surgery that clearly wasn't scheduled because she had appointments like in the few days after it. And if it was a routine surgery, she should have been out in a few days. Like if you get an appendectomy, you're like, you're back on your feet in a couple days later. And like, this is a woman who was like outside of the hospital in heels holding her newborn baby, like the day after her baby was born. Right. Like, so she's like physically capable, but then she's been gone for 2 months in this hospital with no press, no, like even getting on a, you know, Zoom to say hi, like I'm fine. And so people start getting more and more suspicious. And then they put out that photo of her with her kids and it's like clearly photoshopped. And so they have to retract it. And then, so this is like, it's weird, right? Like,
it's strange.
Yeah. Oh, man.
I feel like there's a certain like class of conspiracy theory these days that it's almost like we're all so bored. It's like, it feels like 15 years ago, we would have been like, who cares? Like, can we stop? And today it's like, there's investigations and it's like a whole thing.
It's also vague enough of like what they did with the Photoshop thing that anybody can like throw their own theory in there, their own like pet theory to be like, what's wrong? So yeah,
I hope she's okay.
That makes it more fun.
I hope she's okay. That's what people should be saying. Well, I just found out about it. Okay, the House of Lords.
What did you find out about the House of Lords? Yeah.
To be honest, I wasn't really reading the ChatGPT.
Oh, I have that up. Apparently, it is based on landed, like. There's like different ways to do it, but yes, it is hereditary. And today, so I don't know how it was at that time. I haven't read through like the whole history of it, but today the hereditary peerage, I think is how you say it, is it basically gives you the right to run for the House of Lords. Like you can't even run in the House of for the House of Lords unless you have that hereditary link.
Interesting. Okay.
And the House of Lords is like meant to be sort of like the Senate is supposed to be, which is like a, I don't know, like a, like I think the idea between the House of Representatives and the House of, and the Senate in the US is the House of Representatives is more like the pulse of how America is feeling right now. And the Senate is supposed to be because of the longer term length. And then also the original way the Senate was elected is it wasn't even elected directly by people. It was elected by state representatives. They don't, we changed that system. I don't know how long ago, but originally, it was meant to be sort of this like almost House of Lords type equivalent, like these sort of separated and can like think more long term about the implications of something. Of course, in the U.S., you could become a senator without you could become a senator in the U.S., obviously not from hereditary reasons. But
what is his equivalent? Otherwise, what's his equivalent in the U.S.? Honestly, like a Kennedy in like the 80s is probably a fair equivalent. Maybe 90s.
Got some.
Yeah, maybe it's a Kennedy or maybe it's something from even like business, like a Rockefeller or like.
Oh, yeah, that's a good analogy.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Point is, he had.
Because he clearly never worried about money.
Yeah.
Yeah, he clearly never had to worry about money in his entire life.
Yeah.
He was also involved in the Indian independence movement, interestingly. So he was political for sure. Wow. I don't know. Clearly a very influential guy. But yeah, he was accused of being a Soviet sympathizer. He even went to the Soviet Union in the 20s, which is I guess pretty recent after the Soviet Union became a country.
Yeah. Why was he accused of that? Just because he was against the war?
He was against all these wars. He was like friendly with Russians. Like he the British actually sent him in the 20s to Soviet Russia
because on Britain's side back then?
They were, but I think the communism thing was like always a
okay. Still a concern.
Some they were like suspicious.
Yeah, yeah.
They were, well, actually, the Nazis and the Soviets were the original. They were originally allied together. Mm-hmm. Remember?
Oh, okay. You're right.
Then they switched after they got attacked.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not very good on my like World War history. It's probably something I should learn.
That'd be a fun deep dive.
Yeah.
Russell did say though, when he went to the Soviet Union, he did criticize it on his way. Like when he came back. which was interesting because it says of the other 24 people who went with him on the trip, they all were glowing about the Soviet Union, and he was the one who was not.
Once you guys both have kids, we can do like a long deep dive on major wars. It's like a very, it's like a very dad thing to get into.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure.
We can each pick our favorite war.
I know we didn't do the other Gilbert book that we had talked about, but he has a World War One book that is apparently amazing. And I bought it because of how good the other one was. I haven't read it obviously because it's massive, but if it's written in the same style, I bet it'd be a pretty good read.
Yeah, I would be interested. I actually don't know very much about World War One. I feel like a lot of my history.
Yeah, I know a lot more about World War Two.
Yeah,
I know a lot more about World War Two, and from like my brief, like I've been more curious about World War One recently, and it seems like actually that was more, not that it was more influential. World War Two was super influential, but it was like, it was kind of set up World War II basically, but like the world, it kind of remade the world though, because World War One, pre-World War One, I mean, think about it, like the Ottoman Empire was a thing in World War One, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was a thing, you know, that's where the US kind of really became a superpower after World War One. Like a lot of the world sort of got remade as part of that.
He's got a World War One and a World War II book.
Huh.
Gilbert does? Mm-hmm. That might be like one of those we do for like, we give ourselves at least a month.
Yeah. To read. The World War One one is 700 pages. The World War Two one is 900 pages.
Wow.
Jeez.
Wow.
I would be down though.
I would be down.
I don't know about you guys. That'd be fun.
At least like, you know, I spent a couple years in Turkey as a kid, and my mom is Turkish. The Ottoman Empire comes up a reasonable amount, but I just never appreciated. You always think of it as like this very ancient thing, partially because of, you know, just the way it's portrayed in paintings and like Turkish art and so on. When I was in Istanbul in 2022, I was in a museum somewhere and we actually saw photos of the Ottoman Navy in World War One. And there's like you have this mental image of like, you know, it's an old empire. It's been around forever, like wooden ships and sails. And it's like a modern navy, which I feel sounds maybe very obvious to others, but like growing up with the lens I had on it, when I saw the photo, I was like, what the hell? Like,
I would say World War One is where I'm like unsure on some of that stuff, because there were periods in World War One where there were like horseback cavalry fighting tanks, right? Like, isn't that where a lot of that stuff switched over?
I believe so.
Because that's where at the beginning, because Civil War had a lot of that, and then World War One is where like tanks and like mechanized warfare started becoming very prominent. And I think they just like these tactics were sort of like untested, and they just like mowed down the old school war tactics. Actually, interesting note on that. That's more World War Two related than World War One. I was in Hawaii recently, and you know, we went to Pearl Harbor like people do when they go to Hawaii, and they had the USS Missouri there, which is where the surrender papers were signed. Yeah, in Tokyo, so, or like off in Tokyo Bay. Missouri, interesting choice why they picked Missouri, USS Missouri. It was built during the war, so it was not in existence pre-Pearl Harbor. Like, it wasn't at Pearl Harbor, right? It was basically commissioned like during the war. But because Truman is from Missouri, he wanted the ship that where the surrender papers were signed to be the USS Missouri. So it was a new ship, right, in World War II. But the same exact ship fired the first Tomahawk missiles at in the first Persian Gulf War, USS Missouri.
Wow.
That like ties it together, right? It's like, it makes like, sure, it was a new ship during World War II, but like Persian Gulf War seems like it wasn't that long ago.
It would have been 30
and
years later.
World War II seems like it's ancient.
Yeah.
45, I think, something like that. 1945 to like 1990 probably. 1990. Yeah. Yeah, which is just wild that it was like the same ship. It's also, the U.S. has no battleships anymore. There's no active U.S. battleships.
Is that a strategic thing? Like, are they no good?
Yeah. Yeah. I was asking the park ranger about that, and he basically said they have all the negatives of an aircraft carrier. Like, they're big and bulky. Mm-hmm. Like, the Missouri is bigger than the Titanic, which I didn't realize.
The Titanic's not all that it's big like, by modern standards.
Yeah. Yeah. By military standards. Yeah. Yeah. But it's like big and bulky, but not big enough or wide enough to have aircraft. and aircraft kind of change the game. Mm. So it's like they're vulnerable to attack. They have like 2,500 to 3,000 sailors on them. So they're like a very juicy target, but they have the negatives of an aircraft carrier in terms of maneuverability without the defense capabilities. Mm-hmm. And then the reason they have to be so thin, which is also wild, is they have to be able to go through the Panama Canal. And so the Panama Canal was not as wide at that time, because now aircraft carriers can actually go through the Panama Canal, but it was more narrow. And they told us every time it went through the canal, they had to repaint the sides because they couldn't get through the canal without scraping the sides. It was literally max width of what they could possibly get through.
Yeah. Imagine the sound.
Imagine you finish building the thing and realize you screwed up somewhere and it's like a foot too wide.
Fuck it, we're remaking the canal.
Yeah. Make more money again.
But yeah, it's wild. Like all these, there's usually like a reason for a lot of these things. Like I was wondering, I was like, why were they so thin then? Like why would they have built them like that? Because aircraft were a thing in World War II, right? So it's like not a crazy idea to think you could put a. No, I don't think aircraft carriers were a thing though. So
because I think you needed World War II? Like jet engines.
Yeah,
I thought they were a thing.
I don't know. Oh,
I thought you needed jet engines for an aircraft carrier.
Oh, yeah. Actually, no. The Japanese had them for sure because they use aircraft carriers to attack Pearl Harbor. Yeah,
first aircraft carrier was commissioned by the U.S. Navy in March 1922.
Well, okay.
So right post World War One. Yep. Yeah,
dude, that is so insane. Like, because 1922 is 18 years after the Wright brothers.
Yeah.
So
aviation moved so fast the first couple decades.
It's so wild too. I mean, yeah, I guess we don't, I'm trying to think, well, I guess if we looked at SpaceX, that would be a similar like rapid improvement in technology because they went from, you know, shitty little Falcon 1 15 years ago to Starship. Now,
dude, we're computers too.
Computers are just boring because it's like it's tech, you know, like it's this little tech. It's hard to see the change, right?
It's table stakes a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's boring if things get like smaller, right? Like it doesn't feel bigger. And faster. I get it. I get that it's cool, but yeah, like to see the like Wright brothers bicycle flyer to a fighter jet in 20 years or whatever is like. It's pretty badass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess cars too, because it was like, when was the Model T? That was 1910. And so then it was like tanks 10 years later.
Like, geez. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, anything with a military application is going to move fast.
Yeah. Back when we built things.
I feel like we can't say that anymore. I think we're building. We're back to building. We got rockets landing backwards, cars that drive themselves. We're building. Got to take some credit.
We got small chips.
Did you see that 10-year? You see that 10-year comparison of the Austin skyline? That's building.
That is actually really cool.
It's absurd how much the Austin skyline.
Nat, you know one story. You know one story I tell people. I don't even live in Austin, and I tell this story. I say when I visited you when you first moved to Austin. I think it was like 2015 or 16, probably 16. How like empty East Austin was. Yeah. Like I remember we would
nothing.
Like we went for a walk near your apartment, and there was like nothing there.
Yeah.
And it was cool. Like it wasn't like Austin was bad, but I remember to like go anywhere, we had to like walk towards downtown. And then I was like, oh, yeah, we're in a city. Interesting. Like before that, it was like we're in this like suburb.
Dude.
And now you go to East Austin and it is like, I don't know. Yeah, it's packed.
I mean, it's wild. Like, because, yeah, you came and visited me in that first apartment, Neil. And like where the office is now is two blocks from that first apartment. And it's just a completely different city now. Like, completely different area. Like, this is downtown. Yeah. And this was kind of the boonies back then. So,
yeah. And that wasn't that long ago.
No, it was 2015.
Yeah.
I guess it's 9 years now. It's fucking weird.
Yeah.
Getting old.
That was a nice apartment.
Dude, yeah. It was for like first year out of college, like being that close to downtown. Yeah. And nice little one bedroom. It was a good setup.
Yeah. We watched the Scientology documentary. I'll never
forget. We did. That was great. We watched the Scientology documentary, and the other thing I remember at that apartment is I watched the first SpaceX landing.
Oh wow!
Oh wow!
Dude, that was that year. I stayed home from work so that I could live stream it and worked from home. Cool. It's pretty sick.
That's cool. I don't want to end the tangent party, but I got a question about Logic Comics. What do you guys think about the?
I was just going to make a meta comment. I really, really enjoyed this book, and I'm finding it hard to think of things to talk about from it.
Yeah, I feel the same.
Remember we were starting to talk about that before we hit record, and I was like, let's save it for the episode. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it, but I also feel like a lot of it went over my head for sure. Like, especially some of the Logic specific stuff.
Yeah.
By the end, I think there's like four concepts I think I can articulate at a like high school senior math person's level. Yeah, that's probably about it. But the thing I was going to ask you guys is like, what do you guys think about the nature of the pursuit? Like the whole, and the reason I ask is I'm going to ask in kind of a leading way. Like we sort of opened with, well, you got to chase total truth, but you know, too bad. It's not possible. And we kind of went over it, but this was like their lives, right? A decade was spent writing the Principia Mathematica. A bunch of these guys went literally crazy doing the pursuit. Like, do you guys, when you think about it, I guess there's a bit of hindsight bias, but when you think about this, are you like, oh, this was a vain pursuit, like a purely intellectual, but ultimately pointless? Or was it, do you think it's, I don't know the better articulation of this question, but is it good that this was done? Was it worth the human life that went into it?
I'm glad someone's doing it. You know? It's like I do sort of fundamentally believe that it's, but I'm obviously biased by like knowing Gödel's theorem and like all of that. Like there's part of me that does feel like it's pointless, like also in the Taoism sense, right? Where it's just like you're never going to fully like understand reality, and to some extent it's like, well, maybe just accept that and save yourself a lot of time. But I'm glad somebody out there is trying. It's kind of like how I feel about Brian Johnson, right? Like,
yeah,
I would never do all that shit. I think it like hints at some sort of, you know, psychological illness or something. But I'm glad somebody out there is trying it, because it's interesting to watch and we might get good data from it. Right.
Yeah. Maybe vain was the wrong word. Maybe it's like this like false feeling of control. Like the Brian Johnson analogy, I think is a good one.
Yeah.
It's craving the order
where
there probably isn't any.
It's kind of like wanting to believe in a fair universe or something, right? It's like, you know, really, really deeply believing that you can exert some control over reality and like trying to find proof and justification or whatever for that. But, you know, maybe there is something, right? Like, somebody was pointing this out recently where they were like, it's hard to imagine how insane it must have been when Einstein came out with like the E equals MC squared equation. Because it's like, that's literally the most insane equation imaginable, right? It's like, oh, all energy and matter in the universe is represented simply by squaring this other constant. Like, it's that simple. You look at like all of these other like fundamental equations in nature or whatnot, and you know, like, you know, there's like much more complicated things, right? And then this is like so simple, and it connects like everything in the universe, and it's just like it's absurd, right?
Yeah.
And so there is also this element of like, you see that and you go like, maybe there are more of those and we just like haven't figured them out yet, right? I feel like gravity, like maybe we'll find something like that for gravity, right?
So another feeling I had,
someone's looking for it
with the scale of these pursuits, is it felt a little bit like trying to skip to the end. It's like you could have certain truths that are emergent. You like have iterative discoveries about, you know, the nature of things and so on. And this was a bit like, forget it. We're going to go all the way to the end and solve everything. Like the foundation of all math and all logic.
Well, were they going to the end? Because it felt more like they were. I mean, to the point about the vanity.
They're trying to get to first principles.
Yeah, they spent 400 pages trying to prove that 1 + 1 = 2, right? Mm-hmm. Or 1 + 2 = 3, right? Like they're trying to prove the most basic, boring things. It reminded me of like a lot of philosophy that is trying to prove or argue things that are just like kind of fundamentally boring and useless. Like all of this argument within, and I'm sure somebody out there will disagree with me on this, but you know, there's all of these like epistemological arguments about what can you say, you know, right? And it's like the one that comes to mind is, you know, this common saying that like, oh, it's, you could know it if it's true and if you're justified in believing it's true, right? And, you know, because it's like, if you believe something and it turns out to be true, but you had no reason to believe it, then you can't really say you knew it. And if you have a really strong reason to believe something, but it's false, then you didn't really know it either. And then it's like, okay, well, but what if you know that when you get home, your lawn is going to be mowed because you paid someone to come mow your lawn and, you know, they always do it in the past. So, and then when you come home, your lawn is mowed, right? It's like, okay, it was true and you were justified in believing it was true, but what actually happened was like that person didn't come mow your lawn, and then like your neighbor saw that they forgot and came over and mowed your lawn. So like you kind of knew and you were kind of justified in knowing, but your reason for being justified in knowing turned out to not be correct. So like, did you actually know that your lawn was going to be mowed or not? Right? It's like, you can kind of like play those games forever. And it seems like, to the point of vanity, it seems sort of silly, right? Like, why are we arguing about this? But
There was a line in the book where they're basically saying, oh, it's worth doing this. This is a kind of a response refutation to my own point, but I'd forgotten about it till you started, Nat. There was a line in the book where if we don't do this, then everything else we have proved is like built on vapor.
Yeah.
I guess I can kind of understand that. Yeah. It's a bit like, I don't need to know that.
It would be like if we found out we lived in a simulation or something, that like nothing really changes in our day-to-day lives because this is the simulation we live in. You know, so I can see the pursuit of it, right? It is like really interesting of what they're doing. And it's, I mean, the simulation thing would probably be a bigger thing, frankly. But like, you know, the idea still stands of just, it is probably not going to change anyone's day-to-day life. Like 1 + 2 = 3 is just what it is.
Yeah.
You know, from a day-to-day standpoint, it works enough times. It's consistent. Like, it's not going to change your life if you prove it. Or if you disprove it, it's still, like, it doesn't really change that 1 + 2 = 3 for everyone.
It's like sufficiently correct.
Yes.
Well, and that to me is actually like one of the more interesting versions of this argument is like, and I know Jordan Peterson talks about this a lot, but like a belief can be true while not satisfying the conditions of logic, right? Mm. Like, you know, if you live a sinful life, like you will go to hell, right? Like in many ways, that's a very true belief. Like your life will be hellish if you are like constantly indulging in the major sins of Christianity, right? Like you don't have to believe in anything in the Bible for like that to be true. Right. And so it, in like, in some ways getting hung up on like, you know, well, we don't know if like Moses actually got the Ten Commandments, like that might just be made up. Like, it might be a story. Like it doesn't matter. Right. Like the idea could still be functionally true, even if it's not logically provable.
Yeah. And on the other hand, and like, I generally agree that it's a little like this pursuit was a little bit like it doesn't matter in some ways. But I do think on the other hand, it is also like, it's like anything that was like a technological dead end that people tried to do and spend a lot of time on. Like, wasn't Newton an alchemist?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah.
And it's like that didn't go anywhere. But like, we only know that now. And we think that, okay, yeah, that's like, why did he spend his time doing that? But it's like maybe one of those hindsight things. He was probably like, if I'm right, this is like the most incredible thing that ever could be invented. And a lot of the things that did get invented are kind of like magical, if you think about it. right? And it's like, so it's easy for us to be like, oh, alchemy would be like magic, but so is flying. So is kind of like the internet too.
Yeah.
It's a little bit magical. Yeah. It's just that Wi-Fi is freaking magical. There's no wires and we're connected to the internet.
Fiber like, optic cables. Yeah.
It's like we were talking about this with electricity, right? It's like, it's hard to believe in electricity, right? Yeah. It's like, oh, I put this rope into the wall and then I get what's apparently perpetual motion, right?
Yeah.
It's like you're fucking with me.
Yeah, like, so I guess it's like, all I'm saying is it's easy for us to look at this pursuit and be like, oh yeah, that was pointless because it didn't work. But if it had worked,
for what it's worth, I didn't ask because I think it was necessarily pointless. I just couldn't decide if I thought it was pointless.
No, yeah. Same. Yep. Yeah.
I think it's funny, like, you know, you see the people on Twitter where it's like, if you're a billionaire, like, why are you trying to go to space? Like, why don't you save some people and like give them food and all this shit? And I always think those are kind of stupid because it's like, yeah, space is, you know, like a huge technological opportunity, blah, blah, blah. Like, if you're a billionaire and you're spending all day trying to prove 1 + 2 = 3, like, maybe you do need some, like, better ambitions.
Has anyone tried responding to Gödel, or has he had the last word?
That's a good question.
Let's ask the internet.
Well, Gödel proved it. Oh, that was the difference.
It's a theorem, right? Mm-hmm. I think with Gödel.
Yeah, yeah. Like he actually constructed a proof for it that has not been disproven. So I think that it is the last word in that sense. Because that was the big difference between Gödel and what all these guys were doing is like none of them really proved anything. They had a lot of ideas. Although was Cantor's set theory proven and then got disproven,
or was it just Russell's paradox, which
Russell disproved it, right?
Disproved set theory, yeah.
So yeah, I guess Gödel could be disproven, but yeah. But the thing I was going to say is like all this stuff did end up being fundamentally very useful for constructing computers,
yeah.
Right? Like that was kind of how it did get played out because they were spending all this time thinking about math and logic, and then that helped like von Neumann and Turing and them like build the first Turing machine. Mm-hmm. In some way. I don't understand how Principia contributed to that, but it sounds like it did.
I'm going to Google that as well. I'm curious. Because that sort of answers the question of whether or not this project was worthwhile.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of goes back to the alchemy thing, right? Like, I saw something about this too. Like, you know, obviously Newton's alchemy never went anywhere, but he did make some interesting like chemistry contributions or something. So, you know, like sometimes going at one thing, you might accidentally find something. I mean, that's like a lot of science, right?
Yeah.
So you try to solve heart attacks and you accidentally create Viagra.
Yeah. Happy accidents. There's a interesting article here that has a bunch of follow-up links that might be interesting.
Yeah. Is this what you just said?
There is criticism of, yeah, I just put this link in the chat. We should put it in the show notes too. There is criticism of some of the stuff that was in the proof. Like apparently some of it was a little hand wavy. And Gödel relied on his reputation basically. Mm-hmm. Like there's a line where he says, we content ourselves here with indicating the proof of this proposition in outline, since it offers no difficulties of principle and is somewhat involved. And I guess the author of this article is saying like that section never actually got proved.
Proven. Interesting.
And he said it's surprising given Gödel's insistence elsewhere on clarity and precision, which he also links to. Yeah. Anyway, I have no idea if this is right. This is what I meant by like, it's a bit above, like over my head, but
definitely above mine. I was a lowly philosophy major. I can't even make good decisions like a deal. It'd be fun to reread GEB, even if it, despite it being such a slog.
Oh, it's a big book.
Look at all these highlights.
Yeah, it was a good read, though.
It's a great read.
He like managed to keep it pretty interesting, despite how big and thick the material is too. I also liked one other thing about Logicomics that was not really plot related, but just style related. I loved how the authors made themselves characters.
Yeah.
In the book, like when they zoom out and like show themselves the brainstorming the story.
It's an interesting way to do it.
It was well done.
Yeah, it was a good read. I enjoyed it. It was also, it's one of your, I don't know if someone listening is like a Kindle reader, and I do read Kindle books, but this is definitely one to get the hard copy for sure.
Oh yeah, you couldn't read.
It is a beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe if you read it on like your iPad, okay. But
yeah,
guys, we definitely have to reread Go to Lesherbach. There's like whole section. I forgot how much discussion of Zen Buddhism there is in here.
Snats Zen phase. I'm down.
Made you Zen.
Made you Zen.
We got to update the upcoming book list. I feel like there are so many we're excited about.
Oh, yeah.
Well, what are we doing after East of Eden / East of Eden Journal?
It was the Banana King.
I forget what that's actually Banana called. King? Oh, yeah. I need to start my reread of that.
Yeah. Banana King. And I don't think we have anything.
Oh, actually, speaking of narrative nonfiction, there is a book I just picked up and talking about semiconductors. It's called Chip Wars. Have you guys heard of it?
Yeah.
Have you read it?
I have it though.
Okay. I just picked it up. It like the description and the reviews look amazing.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah. It reminds me, at least in from the overview, it reminds me of this book that I read a few years back, which was incredible. I like still think about it sometimes, called The Prize. Have either of you guys read that? Mm-hmm. So it's about oil and gas through probably the 90s. Mostly about oil, like all the way from the beginning. And then, but it like is not just about oil. It's like about the geopolitical implications, the like war implications, like basically just how it truly like remade the world and also why it is so valuable.
Cool. Sounds like Salt.
Comparing it to like, yeah, I haven't read Salt, but I've heard similar things about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, just about like why it's so valuable relative to other energy sources and like why it became such a important like chess piece in the like the whole world essentially. But it's just written in a masterful way. Like it's like it took a topic that, I mean, Salt is probably very similar, where it's like this could be a super boring book, but instead was probably like,
yeah, it was
like
really good.
I've heard amazing things about that. Yeah. Too
actually, guys, if we want to do a pop book, like something that'll help us in the search charts or whatnot, I keep hearing
Outliers. I'm just kidding.
Let's not go that far. I keep hearing good things about this one. Have you heard about this at all?
Oh, I've heard about it. I haven't read it, but yeah, I've heard good things as well.
It just came out like 2 weeks ago. It's basically about the title for anybody listening is Bad Therapy, and the premise is like Gen Z is the most like therapized, mental health focused everything generation like ever. So why are they like the most mentally unhealthy generation ever? Like what's going wrong? And the premise is basically that like therapy and like therapy world like is the problem. And it's actually like making things way worse, which is an interesting premise. I'm curious to actually get into the book, but it's been getting a lot of like pretty big praise.
Was this, I think I saw something on Twitter. Like an early...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So somebody tweeted out some of the things from it, and then Elon Musk retweeted him.
Hmm.
And then then the book hit number one on Amazon.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I think like the main thing it was saying was something like, when you're forced to constantly evaluate how you're feeling, you're inevitably going to end up feeling worse. Have you guys watched the Arnold documentary on Netflix?
No, I've heard it's good though.
It's excellent. But that's actually one of the things he also says. He's like, dude, I was just too busy doing stuff to think about how I was feeling. And it's like both positive and negative, because he's actually saying it in context of his father and brother passing away and how he just didn't think about it and didn't internalize it until like multiple years later. But he also credits it with why he did so well. He's like, well, you just got to get up at 6 and lift weights. Like it doesn't matter what else is going on in the world.
Yeah.
Is that where that famous clip where he's like talking about all the different exercises he did, and then he's like, so what? Like, have you seen that? Haven't.
Well, I've seen the documentary.
Oh, but there's like this reel where he's like talking about literally like all the lifts that he did. And he's like, so you do 8 sets of shoulders, and then you do 8 sets of biceps, and then you got to do the curls, and then you got to do the squats. And then he's like, yeah, it took 3 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the evening, but so what? Like,
I don't remember that one from the documentary. That's so
it's like
funny.
A famous yeah, it's like yeah. a famous meme now, just with him being like, but so what?
It is a really, really good
it makes series. Sense though. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. It like it honestly does make yeah. sense. You feel like if you're just it's also like one of those things where if you like the people that feel there was something I was listening, I don't even remember where it's from, but it was like the most it's like that famous thing where like you give the most busy person, you know, whatever the task is,
yeah,
like they're probably the most likely to get it done. So the person on the podcast was bringing up that if you talk to somebody who has nothing going on, they're tired. And if you talk to somebody who has a lot going on, they're tired.
Yeah.
So they were just like, you're going to be tired no matter what, like human beings are like, but, and you're not going to get, yeah, it was just like, you're not going to get much done or sorry, you're going to feel better if you're actually doing stuff than if you're like not doing stuff.
Makes sense. Yeah. Hey. Yeah, there's the whole like yeah, the that was one of the big topics that people brought up was like if you're constantly asking kids how they feel, then they're gonna like if you're asking somebody all the time like have you thought about committing suicide or have you thought about harming yourself mm-hmm. or whatnot, and if you're asking them that all the time, then they're gonna start thinking like, oh, maybe I should be
yeah.
thinking
yeah.
about that. There was like,
yeah, or you're like, no, I haven't thought about it, but
yeah,
now I am.
Now I am. Did yeah. you talk about this on Made You Think? I feel like it was in one of the books that we did where these like, you know, obviously these people had good intentions, but it's like a perfect example of like unexpected outcomes where like there was this big wave of bulimia in American schools. And so they went to,
was it the Body Keeps Score? I think.
Was it Body Keeps Score? I don't remember. But so they went to China to try to like prevent bulimia from becoming a thing in like Chinese high schools. And so they went to all these high schools and gave these talks about like how bad it is for you and like how it doesn't help or whatever. And then like there were zero issues with bulimia beforehand. And then it just like took off.
Wow.
Because like every school that they went to, it like suddenly became a thing.
Wow.
Kind of wild.
I think that's the like well supported case for ignorance being bliss. It's just like if you don't know,
yeah, harm, a little bit.
If right? you don't know the harm, you might not consider it.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I don't know. I'm going to read it either way because
let's add it to the list.
My
should we do it after Banana yeah. King?
Sure. Yeah.
Are we still keen on doing Banana King? I was like excited about it a month ago, and I'm like, I don't
feel like we need to do it. We could skip it.
I'd rather read this and the history books and GEB before I read Banana.
Yeah. Doubt that.
So we'll do this after East of Eden, basically.
Yeah. Or right. any of the history books. What's or the GEB. One? Like all of those I'm more excited about. I'd probably read them on the side anyway.
Dude, you know what would be a really fun... What was the name of the book? I'm trying to find it. The one that I texted you guys about when I was in Hawaii... The one about like the theory of people getting to Hawaii from South America.
Oh, what?
I don't remember this.
Yeah, it's like a popular book too. Hold on, Kon-Tiki.
Oh yeah.
Oh, okay, this sounds familiar.
It's like an adventure book. It's like an adventure book. Like the guy who basically was like he was like a, I want to say a professor or a researcher or something like that, and then everybody kept saying like his theory couldn't be done. Like how could you build a wooden raft and get to the South Pacific Islands? And he was like, you know what, I'm just gonna do it. And then he just did it.
I love it.
That's yeah, it's way. Like a pretty well, I think they made like a movie about it too.
Sweet.
Yeah,
it was a 3-month journey across the South Pacific.
Wow.
He was a Norwegian explorer, adventurer, and writer. He did it in 19 so he's born in 1914, did his expedition in 1947, and then died in 2002.
I always wonder for those guys, like after you do something that huge, what does the rest of your life feel like?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I also would be down to do endurance too. That'd be another really good one. We haven't done an adventure book in a while.
I think that was why we initially chose the Banana King anyway, as like an epic history one.
Mm.
I'd rather do endurance or Kon-Tiki or something, I think, than do Banana King.
Let's do it.
Okay, let's do the kids are not, it's called The Kids Are Not Growing Up, something like that.
Bad Therapy, Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, let's do that after East of Eden, and then let's do Endurance after that.
Cool.
I think that's a great one.
I like it.
Should we pick an epic one, like a long book for like a couple, like a month and a half out?
Should we do the World War One?
Because Endurance is not long. Endurance is not long.
Endurance isn't too long. I'm down for the World War One book.
The Gilbert one? Okay, I'll text you guys which one that is. Well, it's the Gilbert World War One book. I don't know what it's called.
I'm sure he has a World War One book.
I think it's just called World War One.
Volume one, 700 pages. Wait, actually, you guys know Churchill wrote basically like a history of World War One because he was like running out of money after World War One because he was like kind of in the wilderness politically.
Oh, wow. Is it supposed to be good?
Yeah, he like... I've heard it's like it like meanders and rambles a bit because he maximized how many volumes he could create. He made like 5 volumes on it.
Paid by the word or whatever.
I have heard pieces of it are very good, but it's like 5 volumes and like very long.
Guess who wrote the 2005 edition's introduction for the Churchill book? Gilbert.
Really?
Whoa, really? Gilbert's intro is probably like read mine.
Yeah, this is a okay alternative. Yeah, if you're looking for a second book about the First World War,
if you want something that's only 700 pages,
yeah,
or maybe people who would buy the 5-volume or 6-volume or whatever it is are probably great customers of his. So he's probably like, this is a great overlap. Good audience here. Good affiliate marketing.
Right. Wow, he wrote a World War II history as well as a history, he being Churchill, a history of the English-speaking peoples. It's like, yeah, it's like.
Yeah, he was a pretty prolific writer. Yeah. He also, like, in the biography, I'm forgetting who the author is, but it's like, it's the super famous one, the 3-volume one. That like something I'd never realized is like even though he is a noble, like he's part of like he's a distant royal, so he's considered like landed, I guess. But he had no like for most of his life, he basically was like struggling with money.
How does that happen? How could you be like a noble and be struggling for money?
I think there's no like income producing parts of that anymore. It's just like
status.
Yeah, it's like a status thing, but then but with that status comes like appearances and stuff. Like, so he had like this country house that had been in his family, but like to maintain it because it was like massive property. There were like a lot of people he had to employ as part of that, and then they also had their house in London, and there was like expenses with that, and like, but he has like no. I mean, he's basically a government worker like his whole life. So there's like no income as part of that.
Gotta be rich to stay
also
rich.
his mom was American, so it was basically just from his dad, and then his dad, there was like some stuff going on with his dad like blowing a lot of their money, and like so he didn't really inherit much, I think was like part of it. And then he also never like made much money besides like writing these books and like doing paid speeches and stuff.
Interesting.
Should have been insider trading on the World Wars.
Dude, should have been on Twitter and get or like.
Dude, if Pelosi had been course. There, oh my god,
yeah,
she would have made so much money.
Wait, you know there are ETFs now that you can buy that track.
The tracker?
There's like a
no,
yeah, there no, there's like yeah, there's like a Democrat one, there's what? A Republican one.
Oh my god,
there's like a blended one.
Show notes. Send us the link.
Hold up, I have to find this.
Is it on Robinhood where I can buy it and lose money?
There's one that's called, this article is from like a couple weeks ago. An ETF, here, let me put this link in the chat.
Guys, are we buying the Democrat one?
It's doing incredibly well, by the way, this ETF.
Of course it is.
Here's this one. It's called the Unusual Whales Democratic ETF.
Unusual Whales.
That's the troll Twitter account, right? Unusual Whales.
Wow, it's NANC is the symbol.
No, this can't be real. This You're is joking. Real. This is real.
It's up 46% this year.
Oh my god, it's a real thing. Unusual Whales Subversive Democratic Trading ETF. How did they not? How did they not get sued for this?
Dude, the top holdings. Nancy. The top holdings are Nvidia, Microsoft, Amazon, Salesforce, Alphabet, Apple, and Netflix. So you might as well just buy a tech ETF.
Might as well just buy, the NASDAQ 100. But
yeah.
But it seems like this fund's performance is outperforming, right? It says.
Yeah, I mean, it's doing well. I guess the question, like, shouldn't it have some defense type?
You know what's funny? The Republican one is doing is worse. There's also an unusual whales Republican one. And that is called Cruz, K-R-U-Z.
I would have, if you had asked me before I saw the answer, I would have guessed the Nancy was doing better than Cruz.
Yeah, Cruz is only up 15.4%. Nancy is up more than that.
Wait, I'm not getting C-R-U-Z. What was it called?
It's just in the same article. I'm just reading from the same article.
I think you said K-R-U-Z.
K-R-U-Z. Oh,
K-R-U-Z. K-R-U-Z.
This is incredible. I'm so glad this exists. God bless America.
Also, thank you to the SEC for allowing this.
Right?
They didn't get ruin the party.
Dude, they're probably
you're gonna reject the ETH ETF, but you're gonna allow Nancy to go through.
Wow, this is the worst timeline.
Dude, I think there will be there kind of is already becoming a fusion between like a blending between the crypto world and the like public market world.
Hmm.
This is like part of it. It's like this is the meme stock of, or not meme stock, like the meme coin equivalent.
I love it.
This is not investment advice, by the way.
Just saying. How long have you known this and not told us?
No, I just found out. I was like talking to somebody about this and they were like, oh yeah, you could actually buy this now.
Oh man.
Like I think I said something like someone should make an ETF that tracks this. And then someone was like, oh no, that's been done. Someone's done it.
Are you unusual whales now?
I wish. Dude, this is a great model. Someone's making good money on this. Like, yeah, they're just literally copying someone's trades. Like, you don't have to even do anything.
Yeah.
There's no management. Like, you're just collecting. I'm sure there's a fee for the ETF.
Wonder what the
fee. It's probably small, but it's like literally something. A free fee. There's always a fee to the ETF.
All right. Anything else on Logicomics?
I think nothing else on Logicomics. I think we got it.
We hit all the points.
We hit everything we can discuss.
I think so.
So next book is the much awaited East of Eden. Super excited for that episode.
Yeah, that'll be nice.
Yeah. Nat, are you done with it?
Not yet. I've got another 200 pages or so.
His writing is just so good too.
Yeah.
Adil and I were talking about how we'd forgotten that it's like a horror book.
Yeah.
Like it is, there's like a lot.
This just like comes out of nowhere too. It's like, it's chill. Oh my God.
Yeah. Chilling.
Yeah. I had forgotten that too. And then I was reading the introduction and it was talking about how like it got sort of like, it got really bad reviews from a lot of places when it came out.
Hmm.
Oh, he talks about that in the journal.
How
he thinks that will happen because of things that he's doing in the novel.
Yeah.
But he also was, we'll talk about it more next week, but he was also basically, in his mind, this was like the book in his career. Like he basically said, this is what I've been training for like my whole life and practicing for. So he's like, I'm not. And I think he was also successful enough at this point that he didn't need anyone's approval. So he was just like there's like points where he's like, I know you're going to criticize me. The publisher is going to criticize me. And I know the critics are going to criticize me, but I'm doing this anyway. Like one example of that is chapter one, like where he just describes the Salinas Valley.
Yeah.
And then you're not there for the first like 300 pages of the book.
It's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like he was like, I'm just going to open the book this way. Like, I don't care that anyone's going to criticize this. This is just how I want to open this book.
Well, it is one of those funny things, right? Where it's like you read all of these how to write well guides or whatnot, and they're like, start in the action, like never start with description, blah blah blah. And then yeah, East of Eden, the first like 10 pages is just describing a valley. the thing I was thinking when I read the introduction and him talking about the, or them talking about the critics not liking it, is they say like, oh yeah, for all of the like sex and violence and stuff like that. And I was like, I don't remember it being that bad. And then yeah, I started to get like, oh yeah.
It's funny though, because it is very chilling. It doesn't stay with you. Like those parts don't stay with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a pleasant book to read until you hit those jarring points. And then you're like, oh my God. Yeah. And then you're like, okay, back to the pleasant. Yeah. Like
All right. Next week. I'm about where you are in the book. So like slowly doling out the last few pages.
We fell off.
Yeah. So that's next. Then Bad Therapy and then Endurance.
Sweet.
Great. We'll update the website. MadeYouThinkPodcast.com. Check it out if you haven't yet. If you have checked it out, check it out again and see the upcoming books. Leave a review on Spotify. Leave a review on Apple. Tell a friend.
And if you have any suggested
books. Comics.
If you have any suggested books, we have a link on the site. So send us some suggestions.
Ah, yep.
All right.
Cool.
Cool.
Until next time.
Until next time.
Bye, everyone.